For July 7th, 2017, this is episode 64 of the PHP Roundtable. Today we have an advanced discussion about the PHP 7 source code. We talk about scanning, parsing, the AST, compiler, VM, and lots more. I'm your host, Sammy K. Powers. So today, we're going to the center of the PHP universe, if you will, by digging deep into the PHP source code. The PHP source code is made up of many components like the scanner, the parser, the new AST layer, the compiler, and on and on. And we're going to be talking about all those things to learn a little bit more about how the PHP sausage is made. Just a heads up, this is going to be a pretty advanced discussion about PHP source. So we're going to assume you have a little bit of a basic internals knowledge for this conversation. So if you are a complete newbie to PHP internals and you're like, what's going on here? There's a couple of episodes you can listen to. We've actually done quite a few episodes in the past about PHP internals. Just to list a few, actually, these are all of them. But in episode 5, we talked about, we had like a PHP internals past, present, and future, and it was like kind of like a general overarching kind of look about PHP internals. Episode 25, we talked to the PHP 7.0 release managers, and in episode 38, we had an RFC show and tell, and in 51, we talked about what happened to PHP 6, and in episode 59, we talked about what went on behind the scenes of PHP 7.1. So if you're a total newbie to PHP internals, check out those episodes, and then this episode might make a little bit more sense. That was a long intro. I usually ask each guest for their one-liner intro before going live, but for this guest, we only have one very special guest, to talk about PHP source code, and I came up with the intro for her. So here we go. Longtime PHP internals contributor, one of the release managers for PHP 7.2, one of the masterminds behind Facebook's HHVM, and she has an expletive for her middle name. It's Sarah Expletive Goleman. Welcome, Sarah.
See, I wish you would have asked me for a one-line intro, because I came up with the perfect one a day or two ago, and I just like...
Oh, really?
This describes me. Je suis YOLO.
That is perfect.
But I guess yours works too.
I really appreciate you coming on again. You've been on quite a few times, and we've gotten together and hacked together sometimes. You were in Chicago not too long ago. We got a hack on the parser a little bit and have some good times. I've learned so much from just watching you do 1,000 git commands in one line. You're just like in the CLI, it's git blah 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 and git blah 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 and git blah blah blah. And then like after 1,000 lines, you just press enter, and then like a billion things happen. I'm like, I'm just, my mind is blown.
It's just, things take a while, and I don't want to have to wait for them to finish. Like, I am at my core, at my center, an insanely lazy human being, and impatient as well. So if I can just like, just do that thing and then get out of the way, it's great. And I love Git aliases for exactly that reason.
Yes.
I just started at this new work here today, a month ago. And I've already like made a whole bunch of bonus git commands. So while my coworkers are typing like, you know, Python, this, push this arg, push that arg, blah, 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 figure out these things from git logs, I just have a script. I just say git code review, and it just like does everything.
And nice.
And my coworker was looking over my shoulder, and I was like, what was that? I'm like, that's sloth.
You've turned me from a git merge to a git rebase person. That's been my most recent, change that you've influenced on me from the last hangout.
I feel like merge versus rebase is turning into this Vim versus Emacs kind of war of like, well, stop, you're both right. I just happen to be more right than you. I mean, we could sit here and talk about Git all day. Certainly. There are many ways to use Git correctly, and there are many ways to make Git do, I was about to give you an explicit rating, do what you want it to do. but that's a completely different conversation for another time, and maybe we'll have a PHP roundtable with some more guests and talking about how Git is awesome. And God, I just had to reinstall Subversion the other day to get to the PHP docs repository, and I needed a shower afterwards. And
it's
remarkable how much better Git is than Subversion or CVS or name your poison. Mercurial's okay. Mercurial is probably Git's only real like competitor in that kind of space.
when I started contributing to the PHP documentation, and you have to check out all those repos with SVN still, mm-hmm. that was, I had to go back to the like late 90s when I was using SVN to really remember, like, wait a minute, if I press like SVN commit, it like pushes it to like the everyone else. And
SVN commit is git push. Like, it's just like, okay, we're done. There it is. Yeah.
Hopefully no one else wrote something before I just did this. Okay, we got to get into the topic, but before we do, real quick,
yeah, what are we talking about again?
PHP, yeah, what are we talking about? You are one of the release managers for PHP 7.2. So 7.2 is alpha 3 already, right?
I know, right? All of the alphas that are going to be released are released. We're going to beta next. Exciting. More importantly, we're going to feature freeze in about 2 weeks. So all those RFCs, all those lingering merges that haven't happened yet, you know who you are. Need to get that stuff done. There is at least one that is important enough that even though the voting is going to end after the feature freeze, we're probably going to let it through. It has to do with security and checking certificates and things like that. We kind of want important things like that to actually get in. You know, the more trivial things like, hey, I want to add a function to this thing that does something I could probably do in user space. I'm going to be like, nope, not, right. Not on my watch.
Well, the retry keyword will not be making it into 7.2. That's just because it needs a little bit more discussion and time. I did actually put the RFC up in time before the feature freeze. But
yes,
it pushed that so close to the deadline, and everybody was like, maybe we should spend a little bit more time on this. And I was like, yeah, we probably should. So,
as cool as I think retry is, you and I both know that it doesn't actually do anything you can't already do in the language more verbosely. So,
right.
Like, it's just, that's not one of those things that's going to make that that feature freeze exception. Sorry.
Absolutely. Oh, no, I would not take offense. Yes. and ultimately, it's been a very educational process for me. No matter what happens, I don't think it'll pass. I really hope it does. But I think Nikita Pavlov gave the RFC a 0.00, I don't know how many zeros it was, 1% chance of passing. I know he's definitely against it.
Well, the syntactic sugar ones always have a necessarily lower chance just because the argument is you can do this already. Go away and stop complicating the language. Or as Zev once said in a famous email, give the language a rest already.
Right.
There's definitely a conservative streak that runs through internals development sometimes.
True, true. Sketch on Twitter is giving a snarky comment. Git is better than PHP. There's your snarky comment, he says. Thanks, Sketch. Cal Evans was saying that feature freeze is a feature slushy. Ooh.
Oh, so yes, Cal and I just sat down for a conversation maybe 2 weeks ago, and we did talk about sort of the consequences of a feature freeze, and I think we described beta as a feature slushy because it's not completely frozen. You can still kind of sneak things in, and then the RC period, which comes after beta, as sort of a sweaty ice cube. I think was the metaphor that we used. It's a lot closer to frozen, but there's some liquid ablation going on the outside. It's if you really, really, really got to merge something in, we can make it happen because it's just code.
Yeah, that happened with the C springs in PHP 7. There was a pretty crucial a change when it was already in RC maybe 2.
Oh, wow.
And the it was failing open, so like if it wasn't able to generate random bytes securely, it would just return false and raise a warning. So that was a big problem.
Jeez, Sammy, who implemented C spring anyway? Where did that come from?
It was definitely an oversight, but it got pushed in RC3, I think, and it was like, or I don't even know if it even hit an RC before it actually went
a great example of the kind of thing that can get into that sweaty ice cube of we're frozen, but we're frozen in a fundamentally broken way. So get out the hairdryer, melt the ice cube a little. And then shove it back in the freezer because this is not going to work. And my metaphor is getting away from me, so I'm just going to stop right there.
So we're talking about digging into the source code of PHP 7 specifically. And so far, there hasn't been a whole lot of resources out there for digging into PHP internals specifically for 7, because it was most of the resources out there were written for 5, and when 7 came out, it was just like it was completely rewritten in the back end in the non-user land space. But that's changing. Thank goodness. There's a lot of new resources out there. We're going to get to that in a little bit. But I was curious, Sarah, when you're hacking on the language, what is your typical setup from your hardware to your kind of Git flow to the config flags you use when you're setting up? When you're just hacking on the language, I don't even want to guide it any more than that.
Hardware. Like, I love MacBooks. We had this entire conversation about how to run away around finding a USB-C charger because I have one of the few new MacBooks in the office, and of course, there's not going to be a charger at this end of the office because Apple picked, like, oh God, Apple, why did you change every connector at the same time? Yes, I like Apple hardware. So I just like the sturdiness of the unibody construction. I like the travel and the keys, although the newest keyboard is not quite as good. And I like not having to fight Windows as an operating system. Windows just feels like a gigantic snake pit. And I'm sure there are people who love Windows and think Mac is terrible. It's a lot to do with what you're used to and, you know, to each their own, fine. Typically the first thing I do, because OS X is not really proper Linux, Unix-ish. The first thing I do is I'll install a virtualization product, and typically that's VMware Fusion. I really tried to use VirtualBox this time because I'd actually committed a couple of patches to some VirtualBox tools last year, and like I wanted to like maybe get involved in proper VirtualBox development, but I've got stability problems that just... It was when it killed my Bluetooth bus for no good reason that I finally decided it was over. So I do that, and I throw Ubuntu onto there because Ubuntu is like, I fell in love with Debian years ago, and Ubuntu is just like a Debian made better in terms of day-to-day use. Debian, of course, is a little more pure. It's the source for all new package imports into the open source ecosystem, but I like Ubuntu. From there, it's all about what I said before, and that's sloth. That's like, give me some git config aliases, give me some bash aliases, give me some, scripts that do my most common tasks. You know, the XKCD cartoon of like how long you spend on a task, how long you're allowed to spend automating it before it becomes not worth it. Like, I just automatically shift everything to the right there because I am willing to waste time automating, because even if it doesn't save me time, it saves me frustration.
Yeah, same here.
So from there, it's just Linux, right? So I just apt-get install, and I, when I'm building PHP, I have an alias that does my build conf configure make, like, all in one. It makes sure that it's scrubbed out old artifacts if necessary, puts the right -j on it, because, again, lazy.
Another thing I learned from you is the -j.
Yeah, oh,
that's the jobs, right?
Oh, yeah, man. No, dude, you don't... you've got at least 2 cores in your laptop minimum. I don't know what you actually have. You might have
a 4-8, core. Yo.
You might have an 8. Yeah. All right. So you're carrying the big CPU. So you should be throwing a -J9 on there. The general rule of thumb is your number of cores plus 1, because with context switching, there's usually like somebody not really working at any given time. So the plus 1 helps saturate your processor. And turns out when you do things in parallel, you do them faster.
What?
Yeah, it's crazy. What was I just saying to you before we start recording about listening to the Async podcast over again? Yeah.
That's right.
Parallelizing. Yeah. It's fantastic.
So we're talking about compiling the C code with make and using the -j number of cores plus 1. That's the rule of thumb that I learned from you. Now, interesting discussion. You posted a tweet about showing how many amazing cores you had on your system, which was, how many cores was it again?
40.
40. Okay, yes. That's ridiculous.
It is ridiculous, yes.
And I was like, holy moly, how fast can you compile HHVM on that thing? Because HHVM is sort of notorious for taking ever to compile. But you were like, not very much more, because HHVM doesn't really support parallelization with compiling?
That's not entirely true. So the compile of CPP files to object files, those are totally parallelizable, and it definitely shortens the total amount of build time. The build machine I used at Facebook was similarly beefy, and I could probably get a full build done in about 15 minutes, something like that. The not much faster, I said, was relative to my old build machine at Facebook. It's not actually much faster, because, again, you have some like disk threshing time. You've got some thread switching time. You've got reasons that you don't get a perfect, you know, 40 to 32 ratio of improvement on that. It's faster, for sure, than trying to do it on a laptop. You do it on a MacBook, and that thing is going to be like setting fires to your desk for the next day, building that whole thing. It's not unique to HHVM. A lot of large C++ projects have this problem. Just sort of the nature of the C++ language, and just, you know, once you're in a big project, you link in a lot of libraries, all that linking work takes time. So
right.
It's just the nature of the beast. I remember, though, always impressed by how quickly I could compile regular PHP on my work machine. I think it was about 15 seconds from a completely brand new checkout to a fully linked binary on that machine. It was so nice. I imagine my new build machine would do PHP just as fast, but I'm keeping work on my work machine, and I'm keeping, well, technically this laptop's a work machine as well, but I have provisions on my contract to deal with that. Anyway, I ramble a lot, and I apologize for that.
No, it's great. I love it. I've learned so much from the rambling. There's actually a lot of activity on Twitter that it's been kind of hard to keep up with it. But just JT Grimes chimed in. She said, started listening to PHP Roundtable, and Sarah MG is talking about sweaty ice cubes. I'm out.
Oh, come on, JT. Come on.
Wes Stark chimes in. I wonder if Sarah MG is aware that Levi Morrison will RFC tomorrow arrow functions just before the feature freeze.
I wasn't aware he was planning to put that to a vote, I guess, is what Wes means.
I guess so.
Yeah. We'll have to have a conversation about that.
That was a bike shedded quite a bit, right?
Oh, it was bike shedded three ways from Sunday, yeah. We're going to have a conversation about that because there's no way the voting is going to end before the feature freeze. So, we'll have that conversation. We're going to have a conversation.
We're going to have that conversation.
That's all I'm going to say. Yeah.
Sketch asked a question. Is it better to use the PPA from Ondrev? I never know how to say his name. He was one of the developer shout outs, but he maintains the PPAs, PPA thingies for Ubuntu, etc., Debian thingies.
Okay.
Or build PHP from scratch for production servers?
For production servers, honestly, I would actually say go with a binary from somebody, usually. It's not hard to build PHP, and it's not even hard to build it right, but you're going to have fewer sort of questions. So if something goes wrong, you can go and say, hey, I'm using this precompiled binary, and these are the results I'm getting with this input. And there are zero questions beyond that about, like, oh, well, what version of this was it actually compiled against? What compiler version did you use? What this and what that? When it's coming from an official distro or even just a PPA, we've got this great laundry list that tells us exactly how that thing was built and what it's linking against and how and where. And if you give us a repro script, we can repro it with that binary. By contrast, if you built this yourself, then we're like, okay, well, let's see the configure line. All right, now let's show us your DPKG output so we know what versions are out there. Now actually show me an ls of this lib directory to make sure that that's actually reflective of reality. And it makes diagnosing problems so much harder when you're working with your own built binary. That's not to say you shouldn't do it, but bear in mind that that is a potential issue that you'll have to address.
Well, speaking of building PHP, since PHP is written in C, you would expect the typical compile from source, the .config, then the make install. But you can't just do a .config out of the box with PHP because the .config file doesn't even exist. Why?
That's not entirely accurate. So the configure script is not committed to Git. But that's actually true of most AutoTools-based projects, or really most open-source projects in general. We include it for the package tarball, of course. That's part of the release process. You run that build conf, and you have something ready to go. The reason that we and most projects don't actually include those configure files is because it's a generated file that's just a duplication of data that you already have. So if you've got that checked-in configure script, and you've also got the source files, which are these config.m4 files, there's a real easy opportunity for those two to become out of sync and for a later person running configure to wind up with something that doesn't actually reflect reality. So if we just say, hey, step one, run one script, it takes about 4 seconds, then we know that the script that's actually being run is always an accurate reflection of reality rather than a potentially somebody forgets to check something in. We do the same thing with the parser, actually. The parser's source is not actually, well, the parser's C source is not actually checked into the repository. You have to run Bison, which is done automatically for you through the configure script, and that will turn the .y file into a .c file. We should do that for the scanner and the INI parsers and the variable serializers and things like that. We don't. I think it's mostly just inertia keeping us from doing that at the moment. But every time I want to change the lexer, I get annoyed because I either have to not check in the generated file in my local copy, or I have to constantly fix merge conflicts every time I update. So
since you're speaking of the scanner and the parser, the PHP uses, I always say this wrong because I'm slightly dyslexic, but it's RE2C. I always say REC2 or whatever.
I say RE2C, but yeah.
RE2C. Now, that's the scanner or lexer, mm-hmm. right, that basically just takes all the keywords that it finds when it's looking through a PHP script and then assigns them just an arbitrary token that
yes.
we come
so
up
I
with,
saw
right?
you had this in your show notes, so I wanted to make sure I gave you a couple of links because I've written actually 2 blog posts on the general notion of compiler processes and lexers and parsers, and I'm sure I've given you these links as well in previous times because we were working on the retry feature. But compiling a script is a lot like reading a sentence, is the metaphor I like to use. When you, you actually probably don't do it this way, but what you could do reading a sentence is take a first step of splitting it into individual component words. The quick brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. You've got a word the. You've got a word quick. You've got a word brown. You've got a word fox, etc. Those words individually have a minimal amount of meaning. They don't really, by themselves, convey any of the picture of a woodland creature bounding over a canine, but they are sort of the first step in turning just a string of characters into some kind of meaning. We now know that there's a fox involved. We now know there's a dog involved. We just don't know how. The second step is parsing, and that is where we start to group some of these things together into logical expressions. It's like building molecules out of atoms, if we're going to go even deeper with our metaphors. Quick brown fox is a single expressive thing. It is a fox that is brown and quick. Jumped is sort of a infix operation between the next concept, which is the lazy dog. Or lazy dog, I guess, would be the singular expression. It's a dog that's lazy. And then we move up a step and continue parsing that, and we start to group these things together into sort of a tree that describes what's happening in the sentence. Out here, we've got a leaf node describing the quick brown fox, an action node saying jumped over, and then another leaf node describing the lazy dog. So you've got this very simple 2-branch tree that describes what's actually happening. And this is something that can be analyzed and broken apart, and you can build this picture out of it in your mind. In the case of computers compiling a script, they go another step further, and they actually create a story out of that. Step one. Well, okay, this is a bad example because there's really only one step. There's only one verb in this. But step one, we have a jump action. The participants of that jump action are the quick brown fox and the lazy dog. And the output is being jumped over. That is compilation as sentence structure, I guess.
That's great. And it's cool to see that happening behind the scenes with the scanner and the parser. Now, scanner, lexer, those are synonymous, right?
Basically, yeah. A scanner scans through for lexical tokens, or
cool.
One might say it lexes out the tokens.
And for both the Zend language scanner.l and the Zend language parser.y, one's for the, how do you say it, RE2C?
Yeah, so Zend language scanner.l is the source code for the scanner. So RE2C takes that, it's actually a bunch of regular expressions, the RE in it, and it translates it into C code, RE2C. Each of these little regular expressions describes one token. So there's an expression there that is literally just the string echo. When it encounters echo, it's going to turn that into, I semantically know that this is the concept of echo. I don't want to go straight into outputting because we don't know this has anything to do with outputting until we get to the parser. But right. We know that this is the concept of echo rather than just four random looking characters strung together in a row. And we have more generalized patterns that are looking for things like, this is a number. It's a string of digits, at least one digit long. There's no letters in the middle. This is the concept of an integer number. So I'm going to tokenize that as another token, and so on and so forth. Zen Language Parser, we plug into a program called Bison. It's yet another version of yet another compiler. It uses a grammar syntax that says, for this type of expression, these are the types of tokens you want to put together to make it up. And then once you've identified that these tokens fit together in a way that looks like this expression, this is the C code that you should actually run with that information. And so Bison does the same thing as Re2C, essentially. It takes this human-readable definition of the grammar, and it creates a big, ugly C file that nobody should ever look at directly because it's that scene out of Indiana Jones where they open the Ark of the Covenant.
Well, I feel that way almost by just looking at the definition file sometimes, because it's super recursive and it's easy to come up with ambiguities in the parser. And when we were hacking on some of the parser together, it was like, is there any way to make this, to disambiguate this? And then we're like, yeah, we can use ugly syntax. Yay, that'll disambiguate it. Which I guess is the is the way you do it, right?
Well, to continue abusing my earlier metaphor, if you're describing the quick brown fox, why wouldn't you describe the brown quick fox? Isn't that valid? Well, depending on exactly how you define your grammar, it may or may not be. Turns out in English, it's not. No one would ever say the brown quick fox because English has this basically unwritten rule that says this adjective has to come before that kind of adjective. And there's write-ups you can read about this. It's really crazy because we all do it instinctively and nobody realizes why. The grammar is going to have those same kind of rules in there, and it's going to say, okay, an addition means we got to have some type of expression, the plus operator, the plus token, if you will, and some other expression. Those expressions in turn could be other additions. They could be function calls. They could be anything. Oh, wait a minute. We also want to deal with unary minus or unary plus, for example, would be a better example. A unary plus would be like if you wanted to say $x equals plus 5, that's a completely valid expression. But plus now has two completely different meanings. It can be a prefix operation on a single number just to say this number is positive. I'm reaffirming that this number is positive. But it can also be an infix operator on two numbers to say I'm adding this one to that one. How do you disambiguate which ones those are? Well, fortunately, we have this other expression coming before, and we actually have some rules in the lexer to help us get around that. It is a fundamental, simple, basic core rule in the language. We actually have to kind of do a little bit of gyrations to get around it, because it turns out parsing language is hard, and it's amazing that our parietal lobe, or whatever the hell part of the brain actually manages it, does such a good job.
So we're looking at the lexer and the parser, and they are the definition files. They're not the actual. I guess it wouldn't be technically correct to say that that is the lexer and or the scanner, and that is the parser. It is the scanner generator and the parser generator, right? Bison is the generator.
I think you'd be forgiven for using either definition there. The Zen Language Scanner L is the lexer insofar as it defines every part of the lexer's behavior. It is not the lexer in the sense that it is not the thing that's passed into GCC to compile to a program, but by the same token, is a C file really the program? No, it's the binary output. That's the program. I mean, you could have this conversation as far down the stack as you want. Personally, I would call .l the lexer. I would call .y the parser, and I would just leave it at that. Much as I would call zencompile.c the compiler.
Right. Well, speaking of the compiler,
yeah, you like that segue?
Zen, Yeah, great segue. ZendLanguageParser.y. If you take a look at that from version PHP version 5 to PHP version 7, it's very interesting to see how the parser directly tied into the engine in 5, but in 7, it doesn't do that anymore. It goes to, it creates these AST nodes. Yeah. So the AST stands for Abstract Syntax Tree, right? Abstract Syntax Tree. And that's, what is the, like just a quick TLDR version of why we even need an AST in PHP?
Well, like you said, in PHP 5, we didn't have this. The parser, as you said, would just take these expressions, and as soon as it saw something irreducible, like 1 plus 1, it would say, fine, great. Give me an opcode. Give me an add opcode. The input operands are 1 and 1, and the output operand is whatever the heck it is, and that's going to go to the input to whatever's consuming that. Great. Done. This is a quick and very efficient way to write a simple parser. The problem is it doesn't give us a lot of opportunity to analyze the program or even the scope as a whole and see things like, well, you know what? Actually, we've got this expression maybe that's $$A+2. A simple compiler has no choice but to actually create an add opcode of 1 plus A and then create an add opcode of the results of that plus 2 and then create a result of that. So you have two actual adds. An abstract syntax tree allows the compiler to look at that and say, hey, you know what? Adds are commutative, and I've got a constant over there, and I've got a constant over there. Let's fold those together and then create just a single add of 3 plus $A. It has the exact same meaning, but we're now doing it in half the amount of instructions. That's a completely contrived example. I don't think we actually do that specific example. But that sort of ability to look at the script from that tree standpoint, like I described the sentence structure, is something that the AST gives us in a much better way than just bytecode output gives us. Because bytecode output erases a lot of the contextual information that we used to have.
Now, with the new AST layer, you also get the ability to do what Elizabeth Smith was saying, that you could do very evil things with it. Mm. And in fact, you last time you were in Chicago, you showed me a little evil thing you were working on. I don't know if you want to announce it officially, but you showed me a little something that you built a special extension.
Are you talking about AST Kit?
I think it was something else.
Are you talking about FAC?
I think it was something else. I don't want to say
it. Just say it. Like,
you were playing with the idea of rewriting the compiler, but tying into the AST layer, but building it as an extension.
Oh, yeah. So I was toying with the idea of, because the engine is actually decently separated, you know, scanner, parser, compiler, and then runtime. Potentially, you could pull any one of those pieces out and replace it with something else. Very often, you see the first three pieces of that pulled out in mass to replace it with something like an opcode cache, which then proxies out to the original three. But what if you just replaced the final compilation step and the executor step, and you created a virtual machine that worked on a completely different set of principles? The Zend virtual machine is a bytecode stack, and each bytecode is an identical size. It's an opline. An opline has a register for the result value. It has two registers for inputs, and it has this sort of extra extended value, which is just an integer. You can throw whatever the heck data you want in there. These are all fixed sizes, and for most operations, that works fine. Sometimes you need a second opline to store additional data. Sometimes you have to do some weird gymnastics to make that work right. HHVM's execution stack, which I'm intimately familiar with, uses a stack-based executor. So instead of saying something like, here's my one opline that says add results 1 plus 1, you would say push one onto the stack, and then push another one onto the stack, and then execute the add operation. It'll pop the top two values off the stack and push its result back on. It's a completely different approach to a virtual machine runtime, but also a very valid one. They're both very valid approaches. I'm not saying that one is necessarily better than the other, but I was really eager to sort of experiment with that and see how far down that road I could get. I think I got distracted by work or other things, and I just kind of stopped playing with it. But it could potentially either speed PHP up or slow it down or make no difference at all.
So it would be actually changing the VM and not the compiler then?
Well, it would be... So the compiler is technically three pieces. It's that lexer, parser, and then the compiler is the part that takes that AST tree and turns it into bytecodes. So it would be creating that third stage compiler, altering that third stage compiler, and it would be altering the executor, which is that the fourth stage that we haven't really talked much about, the part that actually takes the bytecodes or whatever else and actually makes it do stuff. The runtime.
That's the VM.
Yeah, the VM. Yeah. The virtual machine slash executor slash whatever you want to call it.
Now, that one's been, I think of all the components, when I was going in there and coming up with an implementation for the retry keyword with you and some other people, the VM, surprisingly, was the part that was kind of harder for me to grasp a little bit. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's just converting all your beautiful object-oriented code into a bunch of go-tos, right? And then the VM's just saying, go to this, go to that. Or the compiler kind of sets up the go-tos, I guess, and the VM just runs them.
I mean, there's go-tos involved, but mostly, so... Okay, how deep do we want to go here? let me give some history on Xen's executor, and I think that might help make its modern executor make a little more sense. The executor for PHP 4, I'm not going to go earlier than that, the executor from PHP 4 was basically one huge, massive switch block. And it just said, all right, so we're on this opline. What's the opcode? If it's Xen add, do this. If it's Xen sub, do that. If it's Xen bool, do that. On and on and on, down the list, down the list. Big giant switch block, and each particular block is going to say, okay, I'm add, so give me my first operand, convert it to a number, give me my second operand, convert it to a number, put them together, store the results in a temporary. And then a gigantic while loop that just runs through each bytecode one after the next after the next. PHP 5 adopted the call VM, and this is basically the same structure, but this time instead of going through that big switch block and saying, are you this, are you this, are you this, are you this? What we did instead is we gave every opline a handler field. This handler is a callback pointer. So when we get to the opline, we just say, call the callback pointer, and here's your data. And the callback pointer says, okay, the function you've actually just called is the Xen add handler. And that does the ++1+1=2. That's mostly the VM that we're using today. Ish. There are a few other styles in there. One is called computed go-to. This is basically as you get to the end of one instruction, it figures out where the next instruction is going to get its execution instructions from, and it just shoves, it just throws the CPU over to that bit of memory and says, all right, start running that. What we're getting in, I think it's in 7.2, is what's called the hybrid VM. I don't know if we actually made that permanent or not. It's sort of halfway between that and the call-based VM. It's so far the sort of the winner in performance between all these different execution styles. I forget what the original question was. I just kind of got on this rant of like the history of it.
Like trying to wrap your head around the VM basically is the original idea.
Oh, but yeah.
But once you're in the VM, you have access to these things that the compiler's actually already kind of compiled down. So opcodes, I guess, right? You have the opline, and you can access the opcodes through the opline, right? And the opcode is based on a struct that has, like you mentioned before, you have op1, op2, and then result, and then you have like an extra like extended value mm-hmm. like piece of data there. One thing that kind of was kind of hard for me to wrap my head around with implementing retry is that when we came up with the syntax for retry at the block level, it actually had at the AST layer like five child nodes, mm-hmm. which is more than any other node. There's no other syntax in PHP that has five children. Right. It's only the four is the most, and so that was actually one of the bugs seg faults that I kept running into, and I had to figure out how to like shift the bytes over to make it accept five children or whatever in the AST. What was kind of throwing me off is that since I only have access to op1, op2, result, and extended value, op1 and op2, I could move some data around in that, and I could also use extended value to move some data around. But I also needed to like convey certain other data mm-hmm. that I couldn't put into the opcode or into the opline. And so I think is the answer to like where that data goes is just create a hash table and then use extended value to reference somewhere in the hash table, or
it really varies depending on situation. And I'm going to pop off the stack a little bit there and talk about your retry AST type, because your retry AST type, as I recall, it had basically where the try block started. So basically where it needs to jump back to was encoded in there somewhere. You had the number of times to retry had to be encoded in there somewhere. Was there something for like an exception type?
Yeah, it's basically, I figured out that after toying with it even more, is basically just hijacking the catch block and adding like two new features. It's adding like the number of attempts and the number of times you want to retry.
Yeah.
Basically. So, and when I was doing that, the catch was already taking up all the things. Like, it was already using all of these extended values. It was using op1 and op2, and I had nowhere else to put, like, well, where do I keep track of the number of attempts that they've done so far? Where do I put the number of attempts it should do? Like, that was where I was kind of running into my issue.
So I think the interesting thing there is that the opcodes you get, these are read-only things. So your particular retry feature, it needs to have this sort of temporary variable of, like, well, how many times have I tried? Where do you store that? You don't have a variable to store that in because you're not defining like a dollar X or something like that. You can't just arbitrarily create an X variable in the symbol table because maybe that's overriding somebody else's variable. Even if they name their variable null byte, don't write it here. Sammy will be mad. X123. Like, maybe they use that variable. Nobody knows. So you need somewhere to store that. And I think that's probably what you're likely to have run into as the biggest difficulty there, because we don't actually have a notion, well, we don't have a good notion of virtual variables yet. What we do have is this temporary variable structure that is in the current execute data. And current execute data has a number of things in it, one of which is sort of this lookup between simple variable numbers, compiled variables as they're called, and their actual place in the symbol table. And they also have this sort of packed C array of Z vals for certain temporary values that they're going to store. Temporary values can come around from a lot of places. They can come around from like the output from a print statement that's never used, or they can come about from a function call that has a return value, but you don't always use the return values. Or even just the result of a binary expression. 1 + 1 = 2. You actually have to shove that 2 value somewhere. You can't put it on the op line because that is a runtime specific value. So you have to put it in this temporary storage in the current execute data and tell the op line it's in storage spot number 7. Go and get it from temporary storage spot number 7 in your current execute data. And then the next op line can say, hey, I need temporary number 7. Oh, its value happens to be 2. Okay, great. So your retry needs something like that. It needs a temporary that can persist across multiple VM calls, which is also something that temporaries are generally not designed to do. Temporaries are generally designed to be created and then consumed in the very next opcode or within a fairly short distance of opcodes. Your temporary needs to be updated constantly, so you have to do some slightly different things. I don't think we can actually really explain that over the course of a podcast.
Right. It gets pretty deep, I think.
Yeah. I mean, what's really important here, though, is most of the operations in the Zenda engine get by just fine with two input operands. Because most operations you do are fairly binary to some degree. Even a function call. The way function calls work is that you say, start initializing my function call in one opcode. I'm calling function Bob. And then start sending parameters into that function call. This is where the argument list comes in. So we say, send argument 0, it's $X. Send argument 1, it's the number 5. Send argument 2, it's false. And then we have a final opcode that says, do the function call. So we actually execute the next function, and the result of that opline becomes the result of the function call. So if you plan out how your feature is going to work correctly, you generally aren't going to need more than those two inputs. I say generally, and I keep qualifying this, because we do have a very small number of actions that do require multiple opcodes, and we do have this special opcode called zendOpData, which should never be executed. It should never even be reached by the executor, because anything that uses it should automatically be telling the executor, hey, skip over the next one. We're not going to use it. But again, that's such a bigger thing that we can't really get into on a podcast without writing on my camera.
So TLDR, the op line is an immutable data structure that you get by the time it gets to the VM. Mm-hmm. And so you don't want to write anything to the op line. You don't want to change up any of the op codes. I think last time we talked about this, you mentioned that there might actually be an exception in the engine somewhere where it actually there's some kind of structure or syntax that actually writes to the upline or something while when it gets to the VM, or was that, am I thinking of something else?
I'm not sure what you're thinking of, because those bytecodes, the op cache is going to store a copy of those bytecodes and give out duplicates of it all the time. And in order to save memory and save copying, they're not really always 100% duplicates. Often they're sharing memory for values. And can you imagine one request writing to a piece of data that's used by another request? It would be madness. Dogs and cats living together.
Well, speaking of the VM, there is the zend_vm_def.h. Mm-hmm. That is also a definition file that is generated with none other than a PHP file. There's the zend_vm_gen.php, which actually creates, which generates the VM after you've changed the definition file.
This is one of my favorite parts about modern PHP, is that you cannot build PHP without PHP. Yes. It's eating its tail. Yes, so zend_vm_def.h, that is, again, like we described the .l and the .y as being the lexer and parser, zend_vm_def.h is the executor. It is the definition for what's going to happen. So you'll see every single opcode defined in there in its own little neat block. Whether it winds up in a switch structure, which technically it still can, depending on how you call gen, or call, or go to, these are the fundamental blocks of how to execute opcodes in the Zend engine. That Zend VM gen PHP script is going to create a big, ugly, non-human readable C file. Sometimes you do have to read it. Your face doesn't entirely melt because it's not terrible. But I think one of the interesting things that does is you'll see things like const spec CV unused blah 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 attack in these macros. Every single opcode has the ability to specialize for different conditions. So we may have a continue handler that is specialized for the straight continue semicolon expression with no number. And then we'll have another one that it, so that'll be called continue unused. And we'll have another full complete implementation written into the C file called continue isConst for handling like continue one, continue two, continue three. These can actually be two completely different bits of compiled code in the binary runtime, even though they're represented as a single block of code in this definition, because we put in these things of like, if op one equals equals unused, the compiler, after the generation happens, is going to see things like if unused equals unused. And it knows that that's a truth block. It always goes into it. And if op1 happens to have been isConst, it'll see if isConst equals unused, it knows that's always false. It elides that out completely, and you don't wind up with that code. So you wind up not having to perform these runtime decisions based on things you know for a fact at compile time.
That's really cool. I think Julian Polly had a blog post explaining the reason why we do this. And if I remember correctly, it's basically kind of just like what you mentioned. Instead of having like a giant switch statement to like compare all the values and like what are we actually trying to execute here, it just like makes hard-coded implementations all the way down of every type of possible scenario instead of a giant switch statement. So it's basically an optimization feature.
Yeah.
Right?
Last time I looked, for any given opcode, there were up to as many as 25 different compiled handlers. This is kind of equivalent in C++ to using templates, basically. You will have an isConst specialization of your template. You'll have a isCV specialization of your template. And they're all literally compiled as different bits of binary code, even though they all look like one bit of source code in the end.
Well, aren't macros kind of the same thing? Aren't they pre-compiled little bits of code?
A macro is a very similar thing, but they are far less powerful than templates. What we have in zend_vm def_h are using macros, plus a PHP sort of transpiler that is literally just like looking for these keywords and doing its sort of own macro interpolation to mimic what you would get out of a template. It's different, but the same.
So this zend_vm gen PHP file, since it's like at the core of generating the very thing that runs PHP, I'm assuming it's fully unit tested all the way through, right?
Its unit test is PHP.
If it's broken, then it's broken, right?
Well, I mean, honestly, what are the consequences if it produces bad handlers? The consequences of producing bad handlers in the immediate are is that GCC may not even compile what it produces. Those are really easy to spot. And in the later case, one of our 15,000 tests is going to say, hey, the language isn't doing what we think it's supposed to do. Something went wrong. Is VMGen actually unit tested? I don't think so. Could it be unit tested? Sure. We could have our own definition of an opcode and make sure that it produces the right output. But again, I don't think that would actually be useful because we've got 80% of the internet verifying that it generates a correct VM. So I think we're covered.
Who needs unit tests when the 80% of the internet will tell you if it's broken, right?
Yes. And go on. Somebody complained that it's not really 80%. It depends on how you measure the numbers. I don't care. Lies, damn lies, and statistics. I will use the one that makes me happy.
Well, it's getting kind of to the point where we have to wrap up a little bit, but I do want to actually mention tests, because you did mention we have 15,000 tests internally. Mm-hmm. That is
another
lot.
Another good segue.
Yeah, excellent segue. Thanks for setting up all these segues for me. These tests, they run pretty slow, right? running the entire test suite takes a while.
So the biggest problem in my mind with the tests is that they are serial. Runtest.php, which is the actual workhorse behind running all of these unit tests, it has no parallelization support in it whatsoever. It just says, let's run this one, now let's run this one, now let's run this one, now let's run this one. If you happen to have a 40-core server, you're wasting 39 cores waiting for the others to do their job. The reason for that is largely historical. When Runtest.php was actually written, we didn't have enough tests that really mattered much. Our computers tended to have fewer cores, so we weren't going to get a lot of benefit out of it anyway. And then it sort of continued that way because it turns out we had this bad habit of writing our tests to not really be parallelization friendly. Like, everybody would write a socket test using port 31337 because that's so leaked. The good news there, and props Facebook, HHVM borrowed a whole bunch of PHP's test suite, borrowed in the OSS sense, to make sure that it was conformant to PHP's definition. And our test runner did want to do parallelization. We just basically wrote our own test runner from scratch because we needed to change options to, how do you call HHVM and things like that. So in the process, Paul Tarjan, shout out Paul, wrote this test runner that parallelizes everything, and we started noticing, hey, these tests sometimes work, sometimes they okay, let's fix that, upstream it, oh, now let's fix that one, upstream it. So we've actually, we with my HHVM hat on, have actually fixed most of PHP's tests. I say most because HHVM doesn't use all of PHP's tests, certainly not for any extension that it doesn't actually implement. Some of them are just in the bad category because we haven't fixed them or figured out why they're broken yet. But I think PHP is a lot closer to being able to parallelize its unit test suite than it was 5 years ago, for example. What really needs to happen now is that Runtest.php needs to be rewritten from scratch, in my opinion. The code is very... PHP 4 is the most charitable way I can describe it. It's yes. Got a lot of globals. It's got a lot of strange ways of sharing state from one part to the next. It could just do with a fresh rewrite. I don't even think it has to be a 100% compatible with Runtest.php rewrite, because we can leave Runtest.php in place. It can still be there. It can still do its test, but maybe we have a Runtest.awesome.php that can do the test run much faster, or, maybe provide some more functionality, like spawning servers temporarily instead of having to have this server.inc include file that we've been using to get tests running in various...
Does that even work? The last useful commit was 5 years ago on that thing.
It kind of works when it wants to. It doesn't work well. I think... That was one of those that HHVM didn't ever touch, because our concept of spawning a temporary server is so completely different that we've never had to touch it. And I think it's got some of those same concurrency issues built into it. And, well, long story. Yeah, so, I think that is something that if somebody wanted to take on a lot of work and sort of put together a prototype and get a discussion going, or maybe get a discussion going first and then build a prototype from that, I think that would be a great opportunity. I can't guarantee that we'll actually use it, because people have opinions and yada yada. But I think PHP would benefit from that. And I've made a few stabs at it in my own spare time. It is a more complex problem than it sounds, so don't get too excited. But if you want to dig your teeth into something nice and meaty, it's a good spot to start.
Now, there's been a little bit of discussion, at least a little while ago, about kind of refactoring run tests. And there's been a couple of failed attempts at it and in the past, like many years ago. And I think the number – and I – oh, man, this could be a whole – I think we got to save this for another podcast because I really want to get into that, but it's going to take forever and we're kind of running out of time.
We didn't even get to the stuff I thought we were going to get to, which is the five –
I know. Like, there's so many things I want to get to.
You need to tell me to shut the hell up once in a while.
No. No, this is all good. Everything that you say is amazing. That's how I just, you know, I'm a big Sarah fan. So, you know, so I do want to mention, because we're talking about tests, there is a big drive for doing test fests again. This is the thing that's been, I think it's been really recurring over past, I guess, decade or so. But there's a Test Fest 2017 that's happening. If you go to phptestfest.org and get more info on it. But we, it's a big drive to basically get people excited about adding more tests to PHP. And the tests for PHP source are written in PHP, so you don't even have to know C. So it's a good way to get your foot in the door with internals and become an official internals contributor. There is a website out there, gcov.php.net, which kind of shows you the test coverage and what needs to be removed, or what needs to be removed. Well, yeah, that would be good too. But it shows you all the pieces of code, lines of code that haven't been covered yet with a test. So you can go in there and see what needs test. Now, I am curious, Sarah, do you know off the top of your head, gcov.php.net, what software does it use to show what lines of C code are covered?
I saw this question in the show notes, and honestly, I have no idea. Gcov is just one of those things that the tool that we have for PHP that just kind of runs automatically, and there's a website, works great, and I just use that. Like, I just go to the website, and it says, like, oh, here's what we've, okay, all right, cool, yeah. I'm sure if you search GCOV, like GCOV is not PHP specific. If you just Google GCOV, you're probably going to find some references. Like, here's how to use GCOV with a, you know, compiled C binary that hasn't had its symbols stripped out. Go for it. That is one thing I would say. Make sure you add --debug if you're trying to do that. Debug, amongst other things, does not strip out all the debugging symbols, and GCOV is going to need debugging symbols to figure out what lines you're on. Debug is also really useful for just not screwing things up.
Well, you could, and even if you don't have that, could you still use a debugger like GDB if you wanted to debug PHP?
If you didn't make a debug build, you could still use GDB, but it would be painful and not particularly fruitful. One of the problems we get with segfault reports is we ask people to provide a backtrace, and they are able to provide a backtrace, but the actual amount of information in the backtrace only really tells us one thing. What was the last identifiable function that internal C function that was called before the crash happened? Doesn't really tell us what line it was on. It doesn't tell us what the parameters going into that function were. It doesn't tell us a lot of the really useful things. Often that's still enough for us to make some guesses. It's like, well, here's the repro script. Here's roughly the ballpark of where it's happening. You know what? That doesn't quite look right. Okay, let's... Okay, that's it. but not always. Sometimes you just won't have the information you need without a debug build. And unfortunately, debug builds sometimes have a Heisenberg effect that things suddenly stop crashing. They just run slower.
Well, GDB is one of those things that collided with my Git aliases, because I used to have a Git alias. You know, you got like GS for Git status, GA for Git add, GC for Git commit. I had one called GDB, which was Git delete branch. And so when I started like getting into internals more and like needing the debugger to like all my seg faults, figuring all my seg faults out, I kept typing in GDB, and it was like, you can't delete this branch, it doesn't exist or whatever. And I'm like, oh, I need to delete this alias because this is really interfering.
Yeah.
So TestFest, get your user group involved. Let them know about it. If they don't know about it, tell your user group leader about TestFest, and hopefully you can get involved. I think it's running September through November of this year, so we can just get more people involved with internals. It'll be a lot of fun. There are some more resources out there. There is phpinternalsbook.com, which used to be just for PHP 5, but Julian Pauly has been busting his behind on getting some PHP 7 documentation in there. It looks, oh my my gosh, it's so beautiful to see this beautiful, huge list of PHP 7 internals documentation finally out there. It's been needed for so long. It's brand new. Like, just some of these commits that he's been doing have been, like, literally, like, hours ago. So check out phpinternalsbook.com.
And props to the original PHP internals book people, because they put up this book that it was this website. It's been up for a while, and it's had some great resources on it. But they only just recently, like, open sourced it and started accepting pull requests. And that's what's enabled this, like, newfound rush of development on it. And so props to them for actually, like, agreeing with each other. Like, yeah, okay, we can, like, get a license in there or modify it in a correct way to make it work. And, like, let's just make it happen. And, like, once they made the decision to do that, like, you saw that sort of reaction. It was just sort of like, okay,
let's do this.
Let's do this, because the Zend engine is not documented. Quite famously, I like to say there is exactly one file in Zend Engine that is documented. ZendObjectHandlers.h has got fantastic documentation on every single handler for objects in PHP. And no other file really has much in the way of documentation at all. So, yeah, we need more documentation. And my book is now 11 years out of date, so...
Yeah. Well, so the original authors were Anthony Ferrara, Nikita Pavlov, and Julian Pauly, I think,
that sounds right?
Yeah, for the PHP internals book, which is now open source. And since it's open source, you can go to – it's linked on the website, but you can go to the GitHub repo and contribute your own documentation. I added a little bit for PHP, for adding tests for PHP, but there's lots of at-to-dos on there. Mm-hmm. So if you know how to do tests for PHP, there's, like, lots of good places to add to that documentation and contribute some more. Speaking of documentation, there was an RFC about adding dockety typeity blockety thingies
Doxygen.
To PHP. Doxygen, yeah. What's did that ever pass? I didn't actually see.
So it's still in voting, and I believe, like, okay. I should probably just look up the RFC, but I believe the current status is slightly in favor of updating. Oh, sorry, no, I'm confusing that with a different RFC. I'm thinking of the class naming RFC. The Doxygen RFC, I don't think, has actually gone to vote yet. Or maybe it hasn't, it failed. One of the two.
Okay,
we should look this up. Look this up. When we're done.
I believe is it a wiki.php.net/RFC? Is that right?
wiki.php.net/RFC is where you're going to find it. And if you just, you know, Control F search on there, or Command F if you're on Mac, you should be able to find Doxygen. Is declined. It has been voted on and declined. So that doesn't surprise me a lot, because, like, A... even if it was approved, it's going to be a hell of a lot of work to actually go around and put all that documentation in. In many cases, it's not adding meaningful documentation to what's already there, because the methods are a priori, like, defining their types because it's C. And describing a definition for a single method is a slightly complex thing, because there's a lot of tight coupling within PHP that creates a lot of weird interactivity. And what you'll see if you look at the votes is people who have done a lot of work on PHP internals almost universally voted against this, and people who have not almost universally voted for it. And isn't that interesting? Obviously, the yes votes make total sense. We want to understand how the engine works, and documentation will help us. And I completely understand that. At the same time, the no votes from people with experience totally make sense because of the aforementioned issues with that. So it was 11-16 against was the final vote.
Wow, that's close.
See that? We did that live.
Totally. Well, I know you have, we need to wrap up and everything, and I know you have, like, some stuff that you got to get going to, and I do too. But I do want to mention that Nikita Pavlov also has a great blog post out there called PHP 7 Virtual Machine, which goes really into depth about the executor. You say executor. I say executor, I think.
Tomato, executor. Tomato.
Yeah. And his blog is at nikic.github.io, and it's, like, one of the first posts up there. It's a fairly recent one. It's all about PHP 7. So if you want to dive in really deep, see how deep this rabbit hole goes, because it goes deep. He goes into really depth on, like, exception throwing and everything. It's insane.
Nikita has some fantastic blog posts. Like, if you have not read his blog and you're interested in this stuff, if you're interested enough in this stuff that you are still watching this podcast after the amount of disjoint rambling, like, totally check out Nikita's stuff. Nikita and I were actually fighting over chat last night, But man, I respect that guy's intellect and ability to translate that into explaining what it is he does. Love, Nikita, you know.
Absolutely.
I ain't mad, bro. Come on, bring it in.
That's how I feel a lot of times, like even in open source world where there's like really strong opinions and they're polar opposites, I still feel like there's this, there's still the camaraderie there. That's a word I can never say right, but
anger is a funny thing because it comes from a few places. It can come from fear, but it can also come from love. When something you love betrays you, that can create, well, betray is a strong word. I don't know how I want to phrase this, but it comes from passion, perhaps is a better word. It's easy to not care about something that's not important to you. But if something's important to you, then it's going to, you know, rile you up. It's going to make you passionate.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think that's why we see that a lot in the open source world, because most of us are here, not because our employers pay us to be here, but because we really care about what we're doing. And what we're creating and what we're going to leave when we're gone. And when you've got that kind of an investment in something, then you're going to get very passionate.
And PHP Internals is not short in passionate people. It's and loving people, very, very great. Yes. People. I've met so many fantastic Internals people. It's not a scary place. Come join. The water's fine. To officially wrap this up, the show notes are open source on GitHub. If you go to github.com/PHP Roundtable, there is a repo there called show-notes. Chris Shaw has contributed so many show notes. It's ridiculous. And I love to give him shout-outs. He contributed the notes for episode 60, which was logging and crash reporting in PHP, and also 61, which was dependency injection. So thanks so much, Chris, for contributing those show notes. There are a couple of conferences coming up, and Sarah, you're going to some of these, I think. We've been mentioning tests. I'm going to be giving talks about writing tests for PHP Source. One is going to be at Northeast PHP, which is Prince Edward Island, Canada. That's August 9th through the 11th. If you're interested in writing tests and you're in Canada, it'd be awesome to see you. If you're not in Canada, I would be giving the same talk at ZenCon, October 23rd through the 26th in Las Vegas, Nevada. I'll also be giving a brand new talk called Going Bare, Writing the Web Without a Framework. Dun, dun, dun. That'll be interesting. There's also a...
I'm just getting that image out of my mind. Okay.
Yes, now I'm thinking about it. Thanks. There's also the Pacific Northwest PHP conference, which is a fantastic conference as well. It's May 25th through the 29th, and I'll be talking about getting under the hood of the PHP 7 C-Spring as well as bringing old legacy apps to PHP 7 and beyond. So these.
I'm sorry, you just said May 27th to 29th.
Did I say that? Is it May 25th through 29th?
May was last month.
Oh my goodness! What am I? I'm totally. Oh, this was a copy paste error. Pacific Northwest PHP is happening.
I want to say it's like September or August or something like that.
I don't want to mess this up. Oh no! I don't even have the count. I'm gonna look this up right now.
Pacific Northwest. Doing it live. PHP,
here it is.
September 7th.
Doing it live. There you go. You got it way before I did, and you have the slower internet. That's weird. this is the fast
I said
fingers.
It was slower than my gigabit Fios at home. That doesn't mean it's slow.
Oh.
it's all about relative, you know.
Absolutely. Real quick, I am kind of looking for a sponsor for the Northeast PHP conference because they do cover some hotels and nights and stuff, but I have to cover the transportation to get there, and from Chicago to Prince Edward Island is pretty hefty fee for somebody who just does contract work. So I'm employed by myself, so that's kind of a pretty big hit. So,
and the boss is a real cheapskate.
Right, the boss is a cheapskate. So if you have a company and you would love to get shout out on PHP Roundtable and on Twitter and stuff for sponsoring me, I am looking for a $900 sponsorship so I can cover the airfare and an additional hotel night just for the transportation and things like that. So if you're interested, tell the boss, or if you're the boss, say, hey boss, can I get this sponsored and get some shout outs on PHP Roundtable and on Twitter. So I think the last thing is the developer shout out, which we chose the official developer shout out who gets, I think, underappreciated. We were talking about that a little bit before going on for all of his work, but we chose Julian Polly. Yay. So Sarah, why did we choose Julian for the developer shout out?
Well, I think you mentioned that sort of the main reason for me is all this work on the PHP Internals book. He is also a release manager of Days Gone Past. I think he's still active because it's 5.6. This is his release. verify that too. But yeah, he does a ton of things for PHP, and I don't think he gets nearly enough shout-outs. Yes, 5.6 is the correct answer. Still in the security phase, so still working on that. And particularly the PHP internal stuff as well. Just like so much good resources and information there. Hats off.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Julian, for all your hard work that you've been doing. I've benefited a lot from it. So the developer shout out is a segment that just it gives a shout out to a developer who's been doing something special in the community, and it's a way to reward them back with a $50 Amazon gift card. And the $50 Amazon gift card for today's developer shout out was provided by Zen Training, which is professional training for professional PHP developers. You can check them out, zen.com/training. They've officially sponsored this, so thank you, Zen Training, for sponsoring the $50 Amazon gift card that we're handing to Julian. And the final thing is, to wrap this thing up, we have 2 minutes before I think you have a meeting. So, Sarah, do you have any...
Oh, do I have a meeting?
I don't know. I don't know. You said something about a meeting. I have a meeting, too, so I'm trying to wrap it up for me, too. So, two of us. You're like, oh, crap, that meeting I was supposed to do. Do you have any shameless plugs that you'd like to promote?
So, the funny part is, I'm going to do the same shameless plug I did when we did a podcast about a year ago, and that is, I am heading out on a rally next week, actually. It's organized by a group called Raleigh North America. And every year we do some long road rally for a week with a bunch of other people, usually about 70, 80 or so. And this year we are rallying down the Appalachian Mountains. So we're going to see some really cool things. But we are also raising money for charity. And we are raising money for Hope for the Warriors. So if you could help me raise money, that would be great. I will get the link into the show notes. But you could also look for Team No Sleep Till Brooklyn. With Raleigh North America is my team. So that's my plug.
Woohoo! Nice. Well, thanks so much, Sarah, for spilling the beans knowledge, the internals knowledge on PHP 7 internal stuff. There's so much that we didn't even cover. We just got to have you on like constantly just to constantly pick your brain.
And... More to talk about than can ever be discussed. That's a circle.
Absolutely.
Of the core or something. I don't know. I was going for a Lion King reference and it just kind of fell apart on me.
Well, you're going to be talking about PHP internals at Pacific Northwest PHP as
well.
Yes,
one of my talks is how PHP ticks, and we're going to talk about these pieces as part of it. I'm hopefully going to be a little more organized in my thoughts for that. I will have slides that you can look at and say, "Oh, that's what she's saying. Yeah, I didn't understand that at all." so that'll be exciting. I'm also doing a one that dates my age, apparently, called Who Would Have Thought It Figures, talking about the Framework Interoperability Group, PSRs, and why they matter to you, and cool stuff like that.
Beautiful. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. We'll hang out, maybe do a little bit more hacking on the parser and trying to find out the more ambiguities that it can't disambiguate. That's my favorite word to say, ambiguous.
Yeah, you had a question on your show notes that says, how can one get involved in updating the language? And I had a great response all set, which was going to be, well, just invite your local core developer out to Starbucks, obviously. That's a totally scalable solution.
Totally, and twice in a row, like twice in like within 2 weeks or something, me and Sarah got to hack in Starbucks, and I got to like absorb as much knowledge as possible. And I absorbed probably more knowledge in those little hacking sessions than I've absorbed in like half a year working on this stuff. So it's amazing. I think our next episode is going to actually be about TestFest. So we're going to actually get more involved in bringing some people on who are behind the scenes on that, like Ben. Ben, what's your last name, Ben? I hang out with him all the
Edmonds?
Time. Ben. No, Ben. Crap.
Different
Ben. Oh my gosh.
I don't know which Ben.
Sorry, Ben. I'm going to go in my email because you sent an email. Oh, I got the wrong email open. This is good. Doing this live.
I can't believe
you're
dissing Ben like that, man.
I know.
What kind of. Are you even a professional? Do you even podcast?
I know. Do I even cut podcasts? Where is this? My email. I can't even pull my email up. I feel so inadequate right now. All right, here we go. Pulling up the email, just so. And Ramsey, there we go. Ben Ramsey. I'm sorry,
garlic.
Ben.
Why didn't you say so?
I've known Ben Ramsey for a long time, and I just had a brain fart in front of everybody. Sorry, Ben. Ben Ramsey's been really pushing on that test fest this year.
It's funny, you were saying Ben, and I couldn't think what Ben you meant, because I almost never think of him as Ben. He's Ramsey.
Yeah, yeah. Ramza, the UUID guy.
The UUID guy, yeah.
Yeah, totally. So we'll be talking about that next. I don't think that we've officially got some dates. I'm waiting to hear back on from a couple people who I've invited on for that. And there's some other episodes that are coming up that are really nice. I got to wrap this thing up. If you have anything that you'd like to share on the PHP Roundtable, just hit me up on Twitter. I'm Sammy K, or ping PHP Roundtable. There's also, if you go to phproundtable.com, there's a form on there you can fill out and be like, hey, I want to talk about this thing. Or, hey, it'd be cool if we talk about this thing. Or, hey, so-and-so should be on there. It's great. I love it. So thanks for joining us once again, and we'll see you folks in the next episode.
Y'all come back now, you hear? I got that in before you went off the air.
The PHP Roundtable is recorded live using Google Hangouts On Air. If you'd like to get more information about the live broadcasts, visit phproundtable.com. While you're on the site, join the mailing list to get notified about the next live episode. And hey, maybe even join the conversation at the roundtable. We'd love to hear what you have to say. The theme music is provided by BenSound at bensound.com. The PHP Roundtable logo was designed by Clint McManaman, and you can find him at mcmanaman.co. That's mcmanaman.co. Thanks for listening. I'm Sammy K. Powers, and I hope you'll join us for the next episode.